In this week's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with none other than Dr. Eric Helms, pro bodybuilder, senior research fellow, co-founder of Mass Research Review, and science officer for Team 3DMJ. Eric and I spoke about realistic muscle growth expectations. Are there differences between men and women when it comes to hypertrophy potential? Recommendations for training volume, rest, and proximity to failure, and more. I'm so excited for you to listen to my conversation with Dr. Eric Helms, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe, help us spread the message, take a screenshot, and share this episode on your social media and leave us a rating or review. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Dr. Eric Helms.
Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with Dr. Eric Helms from Team 3DMJ, Mass Research Reviewer and Senior Research Fellow at AUT New Zealand. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's my absolute pleasure, and I would actually love to start off with just a little bit of a background of who you are, what brought you to where you are today.
Absolutely, yeah. So essentially, I'm just a muscle nerd, and I started as a obsessive bodybuilder, and I'm still an obsessive bodybuilder, but now I have just somehow made a career out of that. So I got bit by the iron bug just over 20 years ago now, believe it or not. Fell in love with lifting weights, and throughout my early adulthood, it became a way of expressing myself, dealing with stresses in life, traumatic incidents even, not that it replaces therapy or anything like that, and eventually became my life passion, my intellectual pursuits, my artistic expression, and my career. So starting around 2005, I became a personal trainer. And starting in 2009, 10, 11, or 9 or 10, it became me becoming a coach for natural bodybuilding and powerlifting. We started, as you mentioned, Team 3DMJ with myself and three other natural pro bodybuilders out in California, Alberto Nunez, Jeff Alberts, and Brad Loomis. And our whole mission was to bring a more holistic, evidence-based approach that was sustainable for athletes and enjoyable and could be integrated with their lives to natural bodybuilding. That was a long time ago. Things have changed, but that's still our mission statement now, 15 years later. And I merged or morphed from being a full-time coach to the science officer of Team 3DMJ. So I pursued my education, came down to just being a part-time coach so that I could provide information on a broader scale that was more applicable generally. That actually led to me coming out to New Zealand, where I am now. As you mentioned, I'm a senior research fellow at AUT. I do that in two different research disciplines here, sports physiology, nutrition, as well as strength and conditioning. But essentially, I'm just a physique and strength sports scientist. And what I do here is I manage our strength and conditioning lab, or I should say I lead our strength and conditioning lab. There's a lot more management that I don't have time to do that our awesome lab techs take care of. And I mentor master's and PhD students who are basically where I was back in 2012 when I moved from California to do my graduate research here. My wife and I loved it here. We stayed. And I've launched a lot of science communication avenues in the course of completing and during my my graduate work. I wrote my books, The Muscle and Strength Pyramids, and with my co-reviewers started MASS back in 2017. And that's still what I do today.
Very cool. And yes, your books, The Muscle Strength Pyramids, Training and Nutrition, both of those were actually some of the first books that I learned or read when getting into nutrition coaching. And I loved how just applicable it was and not just some formulas or whatever, but it gave you some really, really valuable takeaways. I spent some time in New Zealand. I lived there from 2009 to 2019 and actually got my bachelor's at AUT, but then unfortunately did not stick around to get the joy of working with you or having your guidance in my master's. I completed that in the US, but certainly New Zealand is not a bad place to be, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And it's a great place. So we were technically both AUT students at the same time.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Very, very cool.
Yeah. I mean, I did my MPhil from 2012 to 2013, then my PhD from 2014 to 2017. So there you go.
Very cool. Yeah. And I mean, it's a wonderful facility, AUT, the North Shore campus in particular, wonderful. So I no wonder that there is a lot of great work coming out of there. And one of the things that really spoke to me in your book, in your strength pyramid for training was what kind of gains we can expect depending on our lifting age. And that's actually one thing that I wanted to talk to you about. What are some realistic muscle growth expectations?
Yeah, this is always a very, very tough one because there's a tremendous amount of genetic diversity among humans. You know, like the average person is probably not an NBA player. But if you find someone who's over 7 feet tall, there's something like a 20% chance that they are. Like someone who's 7 foot, someone who's 4'11", we're both the same species. And there are parallels for that. For other sports and predilections towards those sports like bodybuilding, there are some people who have never touched a weight and are more muscular than I will ever get from lifting weights, which is just a harsh, cold reality for some of us. So the ability for me to tell any individual what their muscle growth potential is extremely limited. Because even on top of that genetic diversity, there are some really interesting realities in that your baseline level of muscularity doesn't even necessarily predict how far you will go or how well you respond to training. And we are just now kind of uncovering individual training responsiveness and whether there are differences there and what causes them. And there are so many environmental factors as well. One of the ways which I really like to classify lifters, which I think is an improvement upon a lot of the existing typical standards you'll see out there, based upon a what's your fat-free mass index or how much can you lift? And of course, invariably, these are heavily biased towards men, because they don't have as much data out there on women, so it's very unhelpful, even more so if you're not a male or a male of a typical size. So when someone says, hey, a good squat is 405, what does that really mean? Not a whole lot. And then what is the muscularity that goes along with it? So I think the best way to classify oneself as a beginner, a novice, or sorry, a beginner, an intermediate, or advanced is actually the rate of progress which you can achieve when training pretty effectively and in an environment which is supportive of recovery. So, for example, if you're able to make progress in the gym with the lifts you're using to stimulate muscle hypertrophy, every single time you repeat that exercise, reps or load going up very objectively with the same technique, you're probably still a novice. Now, if that is occurring on a block-to-block basis or every couple weeks, now you're probably more in the kind of the intermediate phase, especially if you're seeing either reps or load and they're small increments. And then finally, for a more advanced lifter, I think it's important to remember that this is not linear. It's not all the time, because you will have sometimes these spurts of progress, and there'll be other times where you're kind of plateaued for months on end. But on average, you're probably expecting to see some gains at the end of an entire program. So 2 or 3 blocks of training, something around the 12-week range. Now, that is what you're actually seeing in the gym. And that's probably the best proxy that we have for knowing that we've produced an overload and that we're adapting. And that if we're training effectively and recovering effectively and supporting the environment for muscle growth, that should lead to some degree of measurable hypertrophy in the long run. Now, what does that translate into actual amounts of muscle gained? That's very challenging to know. I can give a personal example. I have probably put on about 25 pounds or a little over 10 kilograms of lean mass since I started lifting, maybe a little more than that. And that would have been roughly a 10 to 15% increase in my total lean mass. When I first started lifting, I was around 80 kilos. So I think a 10 to 15% increase in lean mass, if you happen to have, you know, similar genetics to me, which I'm by no means a genetic phenom, but I am like a natural pro bodybuilder, and I have maybe in the 75th percentile in terms of numbers in among competitive powerlifters. So when I walk into the typical gym, I'm seen as someone who's like, oh wow. But then when I walk into, say, the European Powerlifting Conference, which I was at last month, I'm the weakest person in the room. Or when I step on stage at WMBF Worlds in the pro middleweight division, I'm struggling to place, you know, in the top 10. But, you know, if you put me on an amateur bodybuilding stage, I can get a pro card. And if you put me in a typical locker room, people be like, oh, wow, nice physique. So it's all very relative. And there are some people who are going to struggle to get those types of gains. But yeah, it's essentially a logarithmic curve. If you look at some of the modeling data we have out there, we have more on strength, which I'll share that information. There's some recent work by Steele where they've looked at some of the open powerlifting data. And if it took you, say, a year to increase your squat by, say, 100 pounds or 45 kilograms, it'll take you 2 years to make that next similar increase, and then 4 years, and then 8 years, and then a lot longer. So there's effectively going to be a plateau at some point for most people, and then it's very small incremental progress. But I think the best way to classify your lifting status is what rate of progress can you achieve in ideal conditions?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that outline. I've never heard it in that sense with the 2 years and 4 years and 8 years. And that makes perfect sense that the more advanced we get, the slower the progress we can expect. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think that there's more and more research coming out that shows that women can achieve just as much lean muscle gain in relation to where they're starting off with. And I found that really encouraging because for years it was like, oh no, as women it's slower or you don't have the same potential. But now we know that that's probably not the case. Is that correct?
It is. And this is actually something that's been known for a while. There's a great study that came out in the mid 2000s by Hubel, where they took nearly 600 participants, about an even split of men and women across a lot of different age groups. This is a multi-site data collection. It's pretty cool. And they had people doing bicep curls, and they measured cross-sectional area of the biceps, and they also measured increases in 1RM strength. And while there were different absolute gains on average for men and women, the proportional gains were the same. So there was between a 0 to a 60% increase in muscle size, meaning that some people actually trained for 12 weeks and gained nothing, and other people were like, whoa, my bicep cross-sectional area increased by 60%. And it's like, hey, you probably should, start lifting. So similar outcomes with strength, but a larger magnitude, as there's more things that contribute to strength and muscle size. I think it was anywhere from like 0 to 250%. And there have been subsequent analyses that have essentially confirmed this, that when you look at relative changes from baseline, there aren't significant differences between men and women. And this kind of goes back to what I said earlier, where we're not able to predict based upon where you start with how much muscle you're going to put on. So, for example, one of the key differences between biologic men and women is testosterone differences, right? And if you were to look at baseline testosterone levels in two different men, and actually women as well, you'll see it will predict baseline levels of lean mass to some degree, but it doesn't explain the majority of it. But what it doesn't predict is responsiveness to training. In fact, even when we take a whole bunch of various measurements, there's a great study that I think came out of Mike Roberts' lab. I want to say Cody Hahn's the first author a few years back, 12 weeks long. They looked at muscle fiber typing. They looked at some environmental factors like their nutrition. They looked at some gene expression, and they looked at indicators of changes in satellite cell activation and proliferation. And they could only explain about 7 to 11% of the hypertrophy. So predicting individual responses, we've got less than 10% when we take a pretty invasive set of measurements. And that's also including hormonal profiles and things like that. So absolutely, the fact that a fetus gets exposed to a certain hormonal environment, and then even more so during puberty, you can see these pretty significant sex differences at baseline. But then the responsiveness after that doesn't seem to be related to some of those key differences between men and women. And that's within the normal physiological ranges. Obviously, if you expose a man or a woman to a high dose of exogenous testosterone, which is anabolic androgenic steroids, they're going to get some great gains. But within the typical physiological ranges, whether it's for men or women, so which is pretty wild, and estrogen also has some anabolic effects in women, you're going to see some very similar trajectories. So it's kind of an interesting thing, and something that a lot of people have a misconception about. Because if it was true that your walk around testosterone levels as a male were going to predict whether you could be Mr. Olympia or not, then we would expect women could basically not make any gains. And that's just simply not the case.
Yeah, thankfully, absolutely. Thankfully, and thank you for kind of explaining that, or explaining a little bit more about how Hormone exposure, even during childhood or adolescence, influences that. I actually read, I think it was a review about where they were more or less criticizing the International Olympic Committee's position stance on transgender athletes. Just because, I mean, just because someone is now under a certain level of testosterone doesn't mean that they did not benefit from a higher testosterone exposure during adolescence, etc. But I mean, that's a whole different topic in and of itself. What I would like to pick your brain on is what kind of advanced muscle growth or bulking strategies can we employ now, if we are more in that advanced sort of category and we don't want to wait 10 years before our next lift goes up?
Yeah, Lisa, that's an excellent caveat at the end there, because I actually don't think the data supports that you need to do more to grow as an advanced lifter. But I think if you don't want to see extremely slow progress, you need to find a way to induce a higher stimulus. So there's some interesting research also looking at modeling data. There was some research also done by Steele. Big shout out to James Steele. There's a lot of cool stuff where they were looking at a specific company that uses what would be described as high intensity training. So a single set to failure per muscle group once per week. So we're talking about just one set to failure. And this was primarily done in like a middle-aged population of people looking for time-efficient training. So we're not talking about bodybuilders, but they came in, they're supervised and being pushed to failure on a series of machines, one set. These folks plateaued right about the 1 to 2 year mark and were not making significant strength gains after that could be quantified, or at least it took another 6 years to see a little bit of a change. They're effectively plateaued. So what this tells you is that the minimum effective dose of training to get to a certain level probably goes up. Like you can do 1 to 2 sets for your entire career, but you'll probably never get beyond the early stage intermediate phase. You might still be growing, maybe, but effectively you've created a new baseline threshold. So if we wanted to take these people after those first 1 to 2 year mark and actually get them to the intermediate stage, we probably need to start doing 2 sets or maybe 3 sets or 4 sets or something like that. And then effectively they would probably plateau again. So that is not to say that they must do 8 sets to progress as an intermediate or 10 sets as an advanced lifter. It's that if you want to overcome that logarithmic slowing down of progress, you need to compensate for the fact that you're going to grow slower by enhancing the dose. Now, the dose doesn't just get increased by volume. I think sometimes the terminology of minimum, maximum, or maximum recoverable volume is it's too focused on the volume, because you could do things like choose more effective exercises. You could do things like trying to enhance the recovery side of the equation, really getting a lot out of your sleep, maximizing your nutrition, choosing exercises which are more effective, training past failure, doing drop sets after that one set, so it's one extended set or whatever. But in aggregate, if we think about the training dose, effectively, if you just keep training in the same way, you will, if it's a sufficient amount to eventually get you to advance, you're just going to see this incremental slowing of progress. You can't fully offset that, but you can to some degree. I'm going to speak about some not yet even preprinted data that's coming out of FAU. Some great folks over at Data Driven Strength. This particular meta-regression that I'm going to refer to is by Josh Pellant. He's a PhD candidate, and I have the honor of being on his committee. This is the same group that published the meta-regression on training to failure that looked at the relationship between hypertrophy and repetitions in reserve. They're doing this with volume, and I'm not saying anything that hasn't already been repeated on other channels like Milo Wolf's and a few others on like the Stronger by Science podcast. So I'm not spoiling the plot, but do be aware, has not been preprinted yet, and therefore has not even been peer-reviewed yet. But as I understand it, there seems to be a relationship between the volume you do and the hypertrophy that is pretty linear, but it's not a linear, like it's not completely linear. It's actually a diminishing returns effect. So there's a dose response. But I think essentially the way it is best described is, again, kind of this logarithmic, not in our favor effect, where every doubling of sets per week per muscle group results in a 50% increase in the rate of gain. So for example, if one set is providing you with 50% of your maximum stimulus. You know, two takes you to 75, and then four takes you to 87, and then eight, you know, to probably close to 100. And then that's not the exact relationship because it extends all the way up to around 30 to 40 sets, believe it or not. But at that point, you're looking at some really inefficient training in terms of the return on investment. You know, if you have to go from 15 sets to 30 sets to get a 50% increase, and you've already had that kind of marginal increase a couple times, you're not going to fully offset the fact that you're advanced. And we also have to consider that doing 30 sets compared to 15 sets, well, that may be a decision one makes if they're really trying to make the maximum amount of progress they can in a given time unit or time window. We measure injuries in sports per 1,000 hours of training. So if you're doubling your training volume, you're probably roughly doubling your time spent in the gym. And then you have to consider, are you potentially risking a tortoise versus hare scenario? Meaning that if you sustain a significant injury, and I'm not saying that higher volume causes injury, I'm just saying that more exposure equals more risk. I think we can agree to that. Barbell medicine, don't at me. That if you spend twice as much time training, there's two times the likelihood of exposure to injury. And does that set you back more than the potential gains you'd make? Also, with when you're doing 30 sets of hard training, are you able to sustain an appropriate focus? Are you able to train close to failure? Are you able to bring the same type of energy and intensity to the gym? And do you have an environment that's conducive to recovering from that? Now, again, the meta-regression indicates there is this continued linear effect of doing more and growing. So it indicates that on average, people are, at least while they're in a study. But I think we need to understand the limitations of what happens when we create these controlled environments to study this, right? Because the data is not perfectly translatable to the real world. We can't say, hey, you should do 30 sets for all muscle groups, for everybody, all the time to maximize growth. Because what we really have are primarily 6 to 12 week long studies, with most of them lasting about 8 weeks, of people training typically three times per week, and typically dominated by exercises which train the muscle groups, which are then going to be tested via ultrasound, because that is what's ecologically feasible in terms of how often the participants are available and will they drop out? How many research assistants do you have? How long can you keep someone in the study? How long is a semester? If you're going to have the student body participate in your research, which is the case in most university studies. And okay, if we're going to measure quad, bicep, and pec thickness, we want to make sure we're training those muscle groups. So perhaps things like hamstrings, triceps, and a few other muscle groups are not being effectively trained. So what we actually know pretty confidently is that when training for 6 to 12 weeks, doing a what we would roughly describe in the trenches as a specialization cycle on 2 to 3 muscles of doing very, very high volumes produces faster rates of gain than lower volumes. So one of the strategies which we can take confidence in using is that if we think it's very challenging to use these very high volumes or very high doses in a continuous fashion, is that we should do something like a muscle group specialization cycle. And again, taking a more holistic perspective, knowing that if we just follow the research, we go, all right, training closer to failure increases hypertrophy, more volume increases hypertrophy. Training past failure increases hypertrophy. Choosing long muscle length exercises increases hypertrophy. Cool. I will just choose only long muscle length exercises, training past failure for 30 sets. That's called lasting 2 weeks in the gym before you burn out, right? So what you would do is you'd select a couple of muscle groups, maybe one large, one small, focus on it for an 8 to 12 week period, and then shift back to a more quote unquote balanced program or specialize on another muscle group. And during those periods, you're taking those specific muscle groups closer to failure with higher volumes, with exercises that expose them to tension at a long muscle length, and just being ready to keep a close eye on the joints related to those muscles and just how you're recovering. And then kind of rinse and repeat and putting them then on like kind of a minimum effective dose, something that would at least prevent atrophy, but hopefully would even create some of that incremental slow progress. And that might result in better outcomes. At least it seems to anecdotally, I can tell you that from our coaching experience in an advanced lifter, to where you'd be making better progress than if you tried to make everything grow all at the same time. And the last thing I'd say is that for most advanced lifters who are trying to increase muscle mass, they're pretty serious about their goals. Most people, I would argue, never even get here. Even pretty serious lifters don't get to the point where they need to think in these terms. But if you are one of those people, you're often thinking about kind of your body as a piece of art, which bodybuilding is a combination of art and sport. And you're probably going, oh, I need to bring up X, Y, and Z muscle group. So it can be even more useful to think in this manner, because you often have muscle groups that either have a longer training history because you're a sporting background, or maybe they just you have less injuries in those associated joints, so you can train them well. Or perhaps just the way they attach and the associated bone structure makes them look more impressive, regardless of the actual muscle tissue. If we were to do, like an autopsy on you and weigh out your bicep versus your tricep, but your tricep just looks better because the attachment sites. So for example, with myself, relatively small rib cage, relatively narrow shoulders, I don't think I actually have small delts or a small back if you were to weigh my muscles. But I need to do, or I would benefit from, I would say, from a bodybuilding aesthetic perspective, more size in my upper body. So I've always done far more work for my upper body relative to my lower body. So anyway, that was a bit of a ramble. But essentially, for an advanced lifter, you need to find a way to increase the gain, if you will, to get more gains, to offset the natural slowing of progress. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can recover from that. So you do need to be very mindful of this, and you need to have strategies in place to make sure that the overlap between muscle groups, the time of the day when you're training, everything is set up quite well to maximize recovery. And then you need to keep an eye on it, autoregulate, and go through periods of deloads and all those things. Typically, for an intermediate or novice, they just need to train hard and keep training in a similar way, maybe do a little bit more when they hit the intermediate stage to replicate something like they had as a novice to keep gaining. But once you kind of hit that late intermediate slump, you have to make a decision as to whether it's worth it to try to push into the advanced level. Because I can tell you that as a competitive natural bodybuilder, in the pro ranks, you're doing things that are relatively unsustainable, relatively high risk in terms of just injury exposure, to get something along the lines of a few pounds added to your stage weight after a 2-year-long off season. And if that is worth it to you, awesome. But for most people, it's simply not, whether they admit it or not. So.
I think those are some really great takeaways in general in terms of overall volume, but also in terms of specialization cycles. And you touched on intensity when you mentioned, should we go close to failure or not? Always going close to failure is probably not a good idea, but nonetheless, how do we know that our training intensity is actually the right one for the volume that we have?
That's a real tough one. And while I don't have strong data to support this, there does seem to be anecdotally some people who are, they're essentially left shifted on that volume curve, the point at which they might get diminishing returns, or they start to plateau and don't get any more benefit from higher volume, is earlier than others. And there may be some people who are right shifted. I don't see many people who are like, yeah, 30 sets wasn't enough, I got to do 50. That's very rare. Most of the time, the limits of volume, I think, are practical constraints, recovery constraints, time constraints. And there are definitely some people who seem to be so responsive to training that they don't need as much. But it's not necessarily the norm. But of course, these people do gravitate towards HIIT, and it becomes like the holy grail for them. But there's other people who that just really doesn't work for. I have trained with highly skilled bodybuilders who have taught me to go to and past failure with a very high quality of training, using effective exercises, and I've actually seen mild regression because I dropped my volume to something that for them is effective, but for me was insufficient. And I don't think I'm too far right shifted, responding well to volume, but I do seem to respond well to it. And as a coach, I've seen people on both ends of that spectrum. So the key thing is, before one decides to increase volume, you want to make sure that you're getting the most efficiency out of your training, the intensity that you can. So intensity is a bit of a misnomer in exercise science. Sometimes people mean the load, or sometimes people mean the proximity to failure. So I like to actually just use that terminology. And if we're talking about hypertrophy, that really is the best way to consider it. It's like the rep range and the load and the proximity to failure. Talking about strength, then I would mean the relative percentage of 1 RM, and then also proximity to failure, because those are the key variables. So for hypertrophy, we know that there is a pretty clear dose response relationship, such that the closer you get to failure, and even training to failure, where you're actually failing on the concentric of a rep, does increase the stimulus of that set when all else is equal. But that's a pretty big caveat. And in the meta regression that has been published and peer reviewed, led by Robinson and colleagues, there's some notable covariates and moderators which make that relationship not as strong. So doing more volume does seem to make that relationship not quite as strong, as well as having a higher load on the bar. So if you were to look at the slope, which is just kind of the mathematical strength of the relationship between volume and hypertrophy, it starts to get flatter and flatter and flatter in one of their moderator analyses when you go from, say, I think 40 to 60 to 80% of 1RM, if I recall correctly. And the reason being is that when you put 80% of 1RM on the bar, you're already pretty close to failure. And from a more mechanistic perspective versus practical, when we look at some of the EMG studies, which are not a great way of telling us a whole lot, but do tell us to some degree about the electrical signal strength, we start to see things plateauing around 80 to 90% of MVIC, which is roughly corresponding to a percentage of 1RM. So when you're lifting really, really heavy, essentially you're turning everything on. You can't lift 80 to 90% of your 1RM, which is going to allow somewhere between, like 4 to 10 reps on most exercises for most people, without recruiting most, if not all, of the muscle fibers that are active. And then it's simply a matter of, do you train long enough with that heavy load to apply sufficient stimulus to make that set on roughly equal footing to a higher rep set? So we do have some data on this. There was a study by Schoenfeld and also a study that was done by Mangine and colleagues. One compared 2 to 4 RMs to the 8 to 12 RMs, and one compared 8 to 12 RMs to like 3 to 5 RM. And they both flipped different directions depending upon the study we're talking about. Schoenfeld compared 2 to 4 RMs, 3 sets versus 3 sets at 8 to 12. 8 to 12 did better, indicating that sets that on average are about 3 reps are probably too short to make that set equivalent in terms of hypertrophy to a set that is longer. However, Mangine and colleagues had roughly equivalent outcomes, slightly leaning in favor, which I think probably had more to do with sampling variance than any advantage of heavy sets in the 4 to 6 RM range, or sorry, the 3 to 5 RM range. So I would say kind of the bottom end threshold for how long does a set need to last is somewhere between 4 to 5 reps. So I often recommend people to train like the 4 to 20 rep range is kind of like a decent rule of thumb. And the beauty of when you are kind of considering, say, roughly 80% of 1RM as a threshold for when you don't need to worry quite as much about proximity to failure, is this gives you more opportunities for different set and rep structures and proximity to failure structures depending upon the exercise. Because if we're trying to accumulate a lot of work, if we're trying to maintain a high efficiency of our training, starting off a leg day that might consist of, say, squats, leg press, leg extension, leg curl, and calves, going to failure with a set of 15 on that first set of squats is going to really make it challenging to do the rest of that workout with the level of intensity needed. However, doing a set of 5, 3 reps shy of failure, and then repeating that for 2 or 3 more times, and knowing with confidence, because your 8 RM is probably around 80% of 1 RM, and that 5 rep set is probably lasting long enough to be stimulative, that's doable. And then you can go up a bit in reps, down a little bit in load, and get a little bit closer to failure to go to your leg press. Now, instead of training in, say, the 4 to 6 rep range, you can train in the 6 to 8 rep range. And you want to be a little bit closer to failure since the load is a little bit lower. Now you can train in that, say, 2 to 1 RIR range. And then finally, when you really want to just give your quads everything they've got, you can do it in a manner that doesn't produce quite as much cardiorespiratory fatigue, and which won't kind of translate to some of that central fatigue, which inhibits the rest of the workout. Now you can train in that, say, 8 to 15 rep range on your leg extensions and actually take those sets to failure if you wanted. Really no issue. So that kind of information is quite useful, some of those moderated analyses. Instead of just failure good, not failure bad, it's when and how do I leverage proximity to failure? But the big question is your failure actually failure? Do you know that you're truly that close to failure? And there was a great meta-analysis by Halpern and colleagues that came out a few years back that indicated that when we actually test people in the lab, they're pretty close. That's when you have a bunch of people around you motivating you, asking you to go to failure, and then you call out, oh, I think I have 3 more reps left, or 2 more reps left, or 1 more rep left. And then you carry on all the way until you do fail, that people underestimate the proximity to failure by about 1 rep on average, with some uncertainty around that mean indicated by the confidence interval. So That's good news. It means that, on average, when someone thinks they're at a 1 RIR, they might be at a 2, which is not a big deal. One of the important moderators in that meta-analysis by Halperin was that when your reps get over 12, so when you're doing high rep sets, your accuracy of RIR gets even worse. And that's because, again, those high rep sets produce cardiorespiratory fatigue. They produce muscular burning. If you think about doing a set of 20 on leg extensions for most people, pushing through to actual concentric failure when you can no longer kick your knee up is probably going to occur after the point where it's burning so much that you just want to stop volitionally. So that kind of haze of global fatigue from multiple different sources can confound our ability to gauge proximity to failure, which is another reason why on these big compound movements, I prefer doing moderate to low rep ranges a little bit short of failure. And then for those isolated movements where you might be able to kind of push through that discomfort using more moderate to high repetition ranges, for example, and actually going to failure so that you know that that is not pseudo failure that you're not used to. Some of the things you can do to get better at gauging failure is take video and watch the velocity of the repetition. Don't look at your face, don't think about how it felt, but did the bar speed or implement speed actually slow down substantially? It should be slowing by 30 to 40% in most cases if you're actually close to failure on that last rep. But if it just burns a lot, it hurt, you're out of breath, and you're still able to kick against the pad or lift the barbell or dumbbell up at a reasonably fast pace, only 10 or 20% slower than that first rep, you're probably still 2, 3, 4, 5 reps from failure, despite what it felt like. You can also do the same test we do in the lab. Go to the point where you think you have 3 more reps, and then keep going. And then you can gauge the disparity between your estimation. The beauty is being overly aggressive and a little too overconfident self-corrects. I got 1 more rep and then you fail. Okay, great. I didn't have 1 more rep. But you can systemically maintain a underestimation of your abilities if you don't actually sometimes push it to the limit and train to failure. And I do recommend occasionally having blocks where primarily on machines and definitely with spotters when you don't have machines of training to failure in a safe manner. You probably want to modulate your volume down a little bit and be very selective with your exercises when doing this just to make sure that you're good to go. But getting some training to failure under your belt where you literally are getting stuck on the concentric tells you a lot about where your limits are. And then when you go back to a training block where you have a mixture of RIRs like that example leg day I had where you got a 3, a 2, a 1, and even a 0, or even a less than 0 RIR where you're failing on the concentric, you'll have a much more confidence that that is accurate.
I think that's another really great recommendation, Eric, to take it to failure from time to time, especially, of course, under safe conditions, especially those machine exercises or isolation exercises. And I think sometimes when we hear, oh, you can train anywhere from 4 to 20 reps, people are like, oh, I want it more to be more specific. But actually, it's great news because it does give us exactly that flexibility that you're talking about of training a little bit more enjoyable in a lower rep range for the compound lifts, perhaps, and a little bit more in the higher rep range for those isolation exercises. So I always think it's great news. But what I would also like to talk about is the rest between those sets. So let's say we've got the volume, we've got the intensity. So now what's a good time to rest between sets in general if we're aiming for hypertrophy or strength for that matter, but also perhaps the rest before we hit that muscle group again?
Yeah, so the rest within the microcycle, like week to week
Both, yes.
recovery, and then within session. So within session is a relatively intuitive answer, although the data has kind of flipped and flopped around if you've watched it. And that is essentially that you need to rest long enough to maintain roughly a similar performance and for your perception of fatigue to go down to something manageable. Because you can have inhibitions for your lifting performance because you're out of cardiovascular shape or because you just haven't actually cleared the metabolites. You're not ready to produce force again. Those actual energy systems aren't quite recovered that require you for those high intensity efforts to just regenerate some ATP. And you may not feel the necessary like cardiorespiratory tax that you would on a high rep set. So the most recent meta-analysis that's come out that I believe is still a preprint indicates that somewhere between like 90 seconds to 2 minutes is actually sufficient. However, when you look at the actual data, it all generally leans in favor, even when it's not significant, towards higher rest intervals being better. And this is one of those cases where there's probably a point where we're picking up marginal benefits of longer rest periods for intuitive reasons, but that it doesn't make a huge difference. And when we look at some of the data on this, when you use very short rest intervals and you equate for sets, pretty reliably, you see that shorter rest intervals are inferior to longer rest intervals for stimulating hypertrophy. But there have been several studies now, a handful is probably a better description, where they have matched volume load by just allowing the short rest interval group to do additional sets. And now, all of a sudden, you see that hypertrophy gets most of the time brought back up to the longer rest group. So effectively, what we're seeing here is that when short rest intervals hamper your ability to do a sufficient amount of muscular work at a sufficient intensity, I think that's also important to mention, that it's going to hinder the hypertrophy stimulus. Now, there is probably some sweet spot to where you're resting long enough, but not too long, which enables you to perform more volume. And this is relevant if the logistical constraints are time for you. If you have an hour to work out 3 days per week and you're trying to get through, say, 15 to 20 sets per muscle group, this is where you actually go, you know, I might want to be slightly under recovered, or I want to use some type of time efficiency technique to get through the volume needed, because I can't just rest 3 to 4 minutes to absolutely maximize everything. And maybe be better if instead of doing 3 minute rests, so I could do 12, 12, 12 at a, say, a 2 RIR, a 1.5 RIR, and a 1 RIR, I would rest for a minute and a half and actually see myself go from 12 to 11 to 9, because it's close enough, but I can get that work done. This is also mirrored by two recent meta-analyses that look at drop sets. So for those who don't know, drop sets in the literature are typically done, they're compared to straight sets, you know, set, rest 3 minutes, set, rest 3 minutes, set, rest 3 minutes, same load, same rep targets in those three sets, compared to a group that instead of doing that, they do their first set with the same reps, same load as the comparative traditional group. But then they reduce the load by 20% and they go to failure. They reduce the load again by 20% and they go to failure. They reduce the load again by 20% and they go to failure. So their load is reducing. The volume load is actually less on a per set basis. But when they get to a roughly similar place, they get equivalent hypertrophy. And when we look at these meta-analyses, when you look at the total number of drops and you count them as sets and you add it to the first initial set, that loss of efficiency can actually be quantified. And it seems that 13 total sets, including the initial set and drop sets, is about equivalent to 10 sets of straight sets. So there's about a, 25-30% loss of efficiency. A really easy rule of thumb is if you're planning to do three straight sets and you want to time efficiently get through it with drop sets, then you need to do one initial set and then three drop sets. So like one additional set in most cases when we're talking about one exercise is going to be the equivalent volume. So that's kind of cool. Now there is an important caveat when we're looking at some of the rest interval data as well as the rest pause data. Sorry, drop set data and also rest pause. But some of the studies, or most of the studies, I should say, not all on the drop set data are often looking at single joint movements, and not necessarily full protocols. And it's important to remember that if you're producing discomfort and cardiorespiratory fatigue, you can find yourself unable to complete the same number of reps or maintain the same load for probably reasons other than muscular fatigue. It might be just your overall fatigue. So one of the things that I think is a very good practical rubric is you shouldn't see massive drop-offs in load or reps when you're trying to restrict your rest intervals. And if you are, that's probably too much. What is a massive drop-off? Say more than 10 to 20%. So I generally recommend people rest sufficiently long so that they can mostly maintain performance set to set and only restrict their rest intervals or use some of these time-efficient techniques if needed to accomplish the goals of the program within a limited time frame. There are also other time efficiency techniques. That wasn't your question, but I'll just briefly mention them. Supersets are a very common technique that people use. I don't recommend doing agonist-agonist supersets, so training the same muscle group twice in a row, like bench press and then flies. But something like an antagonist or a peripheral paired superset is very efficient. So an agonist-antagonist superset would be doing the opposite muscle action. So if you're doing bench press, then you do rows afterwards. And we actually have a couple studies now showing you get equivalent hypertrophy from doing that, but you save a substantial amount of time, maybe 30, 40%, because you're essentially doing two sets and then resting. And fortunately, when you're performing the muscular action of one, the other muscle group is resting. And in fact, those local muscles are actually getting more rest than they would be in a traditional set, even though you're getting less cardiorespiratory rest. So you do a bench press set, rest 2 minutes, do bench press. You're getting 2 minutes of rest before your pecs are training again. But you do bench press and then row, rest 2 minutes. Now they got about 2.5 minutes. So that probably explains why volume nor hypertrophy are hampered by this technique, which is pretty cool. So anyway, antagonist paired sets, drop sets, and simply just restricting rest intervals are all useful strategies, but with those caveats that you shouldn't see these massive drops off in performance. And if you do, you'll need to compensate and do additional sets to kind of bring your volume load back up to what it would have hypothetically been. And a peripheral paired superset, same concept, but you're just training rather than the antagonist, just a muscle group that is not trained. So you might do chest press and hamstring curls, so for example. So that answers the question of what's an appropriate rest period within a workout. The answer to the question of when should I train that muscle group again is similar. You probably want to train it again when you notice that your volume capabilities and your load capabilities, basically your force production capacity, has returned to most of what it was previously. And depending upon the muscle group, depending upon how close to failure you trained it, whether you trained it at long muscle lengths, and also most importantly than anything else, your training background and some of your individual biology and physiology is going to dictate how often you can train without seeing massive drops off in performance. Most people, in my experience, when acclimated to it, can train a given muscle group pretty hard with a moderate amount of volume, pretty close to failure, 2 to 3 times per week. And if you're compensating for volume, even more frequently. I've gone through relatively long periods of time where I've trained every muscle group 5 to 6 days per week, but I might only be doing three sets on each one of those days. So if you're restricting yourself to three sets of chest, no matter how close to failure you get, how intense those sets are, if you have a robust training background, you're probably not going to be incurring too much fatigue when you then come back 24 hours later. And we do actually have data on this, some back-to-back training sessions compared to being split apart, basically asking the question of, hey, is it okay if you're a weekend warrior? If I just get in a whole lot of work back-to-back days, same muscle group Saturday, Sunday, if I compare that to spreading it across the week, and actually the equivalent, actually the outcomes in the short term are pretty similar. So generally, though, the typical person with typical volumes at a close proximity to failure, they're going to need around 48 to 72 hours to recover. But your mileage may vary. And I think that is something that needs to be individualized. But this is why your typical split of like legs push pull, or upper lower are what most people settle on. Because to get to the type of typical volumes that people respond well to, and then a distribution that makes it so the quality of those sessions don't suffer because you're trying to do 20 sets in a given workout for the same muscle group, you end up falling onto these slightly higher frequency approaches, which again is going to be individual, but we have a great meta-analysis that came out by Schoenfeld and colleagues that literally in the title asked the questions, how many times per week should a muscle group be trained? And while they didn't find any significant differences in the volume equated studies, whether you were doing, say, anywhere from, I want to say, this number of sets represented were basically from like 3 to 15 sets in the volume equated studies, whether you were training it. There was even one study where they trained, I think, 5 days per week versus 1 day per week in a body part split. So you're doing three sets in a session or like 15. On average, again, some studies differed. On average, didn't seem to make a difference. But when the volume was not equated, there seemed to be an advantage of higher frequencies, meaning that higher frequency training can be used as a vehicle to increase volume, and that seems to be beneficial. Now, there's an interaction effect of volume and frequency there. It's difficult to really pin it down, but based upon the volume equated moderator sub-analysis and that meta-analysis indicates that it is probably the volume doing the work, but higher volumes are going to be better utilized when they're distributed across more sessions. So, yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense from a practicality point of view, that of course, if we tr train more frequently, it's easier to get a bit more volume in. But yeah, overall, thank you also for the reminder of individuality and that there is a huge variance. And of course, also what our personal preference is, if we do prefer a push-pull split or anything else. I have one last question for you because I want to make sure I respect your time. But I believe you stepped on stage at the end of last year. Is that correct? Something like
I
that.
did.
Yeah.
2023, November.
Amazing. And I would love to know what you believe you did in your off season. So the months prior, I guess, before prep, what you did throughout that allowed you to be successful in your in season then. So whether that pertains to training or lifestyle habits or nutrition or everything.
Yeah. I would say it probably does come down to training and the success that I had in 2023, because in 2019 I also got very lean. I also had a pretty well balanced prep. I don't think I lost too much muscle mass, and I would say my posing also improved in 2023. My presentation, we did make some minor tweaks there, but I don't think it would have been enough to make the outcomes different. So in 2023, I managed to win the New Zealand overall title. And then I won the Masters, my weight class, and then I placed second in the overall Australia and got my pro card. And then I placed seventh out of ninth in the pro middleweights. So I was actually better than a couple other pros, which was pretty cool to experience. When I look at back at the pictures of 2019 versus 2023, at a very similar stage weight, I think I maybe got slightly leaner by the time I was into my last couple shows. Maybe, it's debatable. But one thing that did seem to stand out is that in my front relax shot, which you spend so much more time in, I think my X frame, which is kind of the relative width you have in both your upper body and lower body, kind of compared to your waist, which really speaks to the eye of the judges about your symmetry, had improved. And I spent a whole lot of time specializing on my medial delts and also, or I should say, my middle delts and also my lats. My calves as well, and while they improved, nobody cares. But when I look at the pictures, it's a subtle difference, but it does make those poses much more complete. And in historically, kind of based upon my structure and my strengths and weaknesses, my front relaxed, my front lat spread, and my frontal bicep are where I typically start to do. I start to fall behind my competitors in terms of points. I do pretty well from the back because I bring pretty good conditioning. I have good upper back thickness, and I have pretty good detail in my hamstrings and glutes. And then from the side, I do very well. Those are easily my best shots because it kind of hides the fact that I have a relatively small rib cage, and you can just see that I'm relatively muscular. But from the front, I do suffer. So being able to bring even just a little more width to my delts and lats kind of was a clincher for making my physique look a lot more complete and have less flaws in it. So I think that was probably why I was successful. And the way I did that was I went through multiple specialization phases and kind of just had a default setting of I'm going to do a whole lot more delt and lat work. I was training my delts and lats pretty much every day on a 4 to 6 day per week split throughout the 2020 all the way up to 2023 period, with most of that emphasis occurring in the last 2 years.
Very cool. Thank you for sharing that. And on your small note with the calves, I followed a little bit that you spent some time in a cast or something like that. Not a cast per se,
Yes.
but a stretch machine. I thought
Yes.
that was quite funny. Sounded like an interesting experiment anyway.
Interesting is one way to put it, but big shout out to Konstantin Wernicke. He is a German sports scientist who spent his PhD torturing people like I then tortured myself. And for most of his research, although not all of it, what he did was he was doing these within subject unilateral designs where one calf was either not being trained at all, well, almost every time, not being trained at all. And the other was using an orthotic stretching device. So for an hour per day, it would put them into a 8 out of 10 pain level stretch that had to be maintained. So each time your foot relaxes, you got to tighten it down more and more and more. And actually saw equivalent hypertrophy in one study, or similar hypertrophy, I should say, compared to doing 3 by 5 sets per week. So, like, I want to say that's, 3 sets of calves 3 times per week, or 5 sets of calves 3 times a week, but like 15 sets of calves, if I recall correctly, per week. Now, whether that's 7 hours of stretching is worth the 45 minutes of training calves? You could say probably not, but I was very curious to see if this could be a complementary approach to my calf training. So I 6 days per week for 12 weeks wore a calf boot, and I only had one, so I had to do 1 hour and then 1 hour. So I actually invested 12 hours if you count both legs, and it's not comfortable. Yeah, you. I personally, I started to get like tingles in my foot and start to be in pretty intense pain 20 minutes in. I'm like, and then I go, sweet, just three times more of that, you know? So.
Well, that's very dedicated to research. So, yeah, thank you for sharing that experience, or that experience with us, and of course with the research as well. And just in general, thank you so much for your time. It's been a true pleasure talking to you and picking your brain on so many things. I will obviously make sure to drop all your handles in the show notes, and of course also linking Mass and linking 3DMJ. And yeah, just thank you so much for your time.
Lisa, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking to me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Eric Helms. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. Also, I wanted to let you know that we have just published our free Happy Healthy Holiday Handbook. If you feel like you need some tips to navigate the upcoming holidays successfully, simply send me an email or DM. I would love to share this free resource with you. One more thing before you go. If you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more. And feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.